Yes, on Fridays, we do the week that was. How about today, though? We do the 3 weeks that are coming in this economy. How about that? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Risnell. It is Friday today, the 11th of December. Good as always to have you along, everybody. We will talk about the things that happened in this economy this week, but we are getting down to it for the millions of people who are looking to Congress for some help, as in just a couple of 3 weeks until a lot of the cushion that the CARES Act provided for just disappears. So with that as a setup, here we go. Gina Smilek is at the New York Times. Catherine Rempel is at the Washington Post. Hey, you two.
Hey, Kai.
Catherine, let me start with you and actually, maybe what didn't happen in this economy this week, which was that we didn't get any relief bill from the Congress. And I want you to tell me why.
I wish I knew. I mean, honestly, there's been this ongoing stalemate for months and months and months. And the need, the scale of the need for a bill is just demonstrable at this point, right? If you look at the numbers for various measures of economic hardship, things like hunger or housing insecurity, unemployment, they're huge. So it's not as if Congress doesn't know that there's a huge amount of need, urgent need for them to act, particularly given the fact that something like two dozen additional programs that have been holding families together mm-hmm. are about to expire around Christmas. But there seems to be this logjam over what should actually go into the bill and what tools would be acceptable to help these families and businesses for that matter.
So, Gina, let's take that a little bit farther, right? We've got a piece coming up from Kimberly Adams here in a minute on liability protections, which Mitch McConnell wants. The Democrats want state and city funding to help them through the squeeze. Is it possible? Catherine says they can't not know, and I'm going to throw you the same question. Do they really not know?
I don't know the answer to that, and I think it's impossible. I think it's impossible to know. I mean, I think what's really interesting and what is going to continue to be sort of the core of this issue is that lawmakers on both sides recognize that there is a massive need to do something. You know, there's fairly broad consensus that they need to come to an agreement, that they need to do it before Christmas, that we can't just, you know, sort of end the year and not come up with a solution. And I think that's why it's so surprising and so interesting that it's taken so long to get there. And it does seem like it's really boiling down to these two issues at this point. That's the whole distance between them. But, you know, these two issues could be enough to scupper it.
Do you think, Catherine, that it's possible that they go home for Christmas and nothing is done and they say, you know what, Biden's coming in January and let the new Congress and the new administration figure it out?
Unfortunately, I think it is. I think it's a terrible failure of leadership if that happens. I mean, it's been an unforgivable failure of leadership that they yeah. haven't come to some sort of deal by now. But the idea that in the days after Christmas, you'll have tons of people who get evicted, who lose their unemployment benefits, who suddenly have to start paying their student loan bills again, have to pay their mortgage payments again, things that were in forbearance. I think that would be a terrible, terrible outcome, but I would not put it beyond Congress for that to happen, unfortunately, because again, it's been months at this point, and they don't seem to have endured any sort of political retribution for not acting. And so what's to keep them from doing it soon? I hope that they act, but I'm very concerned that they won't.
Gina, a quick turn to the Federal Reserve here, as we talked about perhaps in this segment last time you were on, but definitely on the program at some point in the last couple of weeks. Treasury Secretary Mnuchin, as we all know, has decided that some of the Federal Reserve's big lending programs under the CARE Act ought to end. It's worth pointing out that while they were undersubscribed, they did add some stability here.
Right. And I think it's also worth pointing out that they were undersubscribed kind of by design, right? You know, they were created on terms that were meant to be backstoppy, and some of them were created to work in exactly the kind of environment that we're about to go into. You know, a situation in which things are getting worse, credit availability is maybe getting a little bit worse as a result, and you know, companies and municipalities need that backup option, and now we're sort of taking it away right as it may be needed.
So I'm gonna go sooner than I anticipated to the old standby on a Friday on this program. What is Jay Powell thinking? Gina Smilek, you get to go first. The Fed meets next week. The chairman will do a conference, and there will be all kinds of questions. But in five words or less, what do we think is going through his mind right now?
The economy's going to get worse before it gets better.
The economy's gonna, all right, that's like nine. But okay, all right, I'll buy that. Catherine, what do you think?
Get the money out now.
Yeah, well, you had time to think about it. You had time to think about it.
Look, it's the mantra, I think, of a lot of economists at this point, other economic policymakers. Powell, among other Federal Reserve officials, have said as much, not in those exact, not in that five-word phrasing, but that they want more fiscal relief, that it's the ball is really in Congress's court at this point to get something done, that the Fed will continue to, use whatever tools it has available, whatever their usual, boilerplate is on that. But really, they need help from Congress.
A quick word here about words that Chair Powell uses all the time, Gina, lasting damage to this economy. How does that manifest if nothing happens in Congress? I mean, Catherine alluded to it briefly, but it's worth revisiting.
I think he's worried about two buckets here. The first bucket is scarring to the labor market. So the idea that if you leave people on the sidelines for a long time out of work and their jobs go away, they're going to have a much harder time flowing into new jobs later on. So he's worried about that. And then I think the second thing is bankruptcies. He's very concerned that if you let this drag on for too long, you're going to see a lot of companies go out of business that just didn't need to, that were fundamentally solid prior to the pandemic, will be fundamentally solid on the other side, but just can't make it through that period.
Gina Smilek at the New York Times, Catherine Rempel at the Washington Post. Thanks, you two.
Thanks, Kai.
Thanks, Kai.
Have a nice weekend. On Wall Street this Friday, not much ado about anything, really. We'll have the details. Man, that was a depressing segment, wasn't it? We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Okay, so let's take this apart a little bit. As Gene and Catherine and I were talking about, two big sticking points in the so far fruitless negotiations on Capitol Hill over a relief package. Help for states and cities, the need for which we talked about on this program a couple of days ago, and which is the must-have for Democrats. And then liability protection, which is the line in the sand for Majority Leader Mitch McConnell and Republicans in the Senate. Specifically, what kind of liability, if any, the GOP says, should businesses and schools and universities have if somebody gets sick or even dies after contracting the virus at work or at school? Marketplace's Kimberly Adams has that one.
Let's say you run a university. One of your students catches COVID and sues, arguing that it's the school's fault. You'd probably have the same concerns as Dr. Reynold Verrett, president of Xavier University of Louisiana.
Clearly, we have concern about certain liabilities. For example, if someone were to catch COVID-19, it's not clear where they were infected, that we want to be sure that it's not normally attached to the institution.
Dr. Verrett is an immunologist by training. He says assigning blame and potential legal liability is tough when a virus is spreading everywhere.
Where my mixed feelings come in, I think it's important that we should have very clear guidance from the CDC and others on what our best practices.
Because that's been unclear from a legal standpoint throughout the pandemic. Various states and cities have different rules. Karen Harned runs the Small Business Legal Center at the National Federation of Independent Business, which has been pushing for a liability shield.
We think that it is important to make sure that if somebody is filing a complaint, they have to really do their due diligence
to prove they were infected at the business they're suing. Other small business groups, including the Progressive Main Street Alliance, say business owners are much more worried about keeping their doors open right now and getting federal aid to help than they are about potential lawsuits. Davis Sensman is a lawyer and works with Main Street Alliance of Minnesota.
If you're acting reasonably, if you're abiding by what your governor or your mayor or whomever says, that's going to be something you can fall back on to say, well, what more should I have done?
And that, says Sensman, is a liability defense on its own. In Washington, I'm Kimberly Adams for Marketplace.
Community banks are, in a lot of ways, a throwback to the days when banking was mercifully boring. Taking deposits and making loans. Personal relationships with their clients, which are local businesses and, you know, people. And according to a report from the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation, boring has stood community banks in good stead. In the third quarter, that is July through September, community banks saw their net income jump 10% over a year ago. And a year ago, remember, was in the before times when things were normal. So Marketplace's Justin Ho got on the phone with some community bankers to find out what's been working.
Community banks were in a good position to do well over the past few months. In addition to their usual deposits and lending, they collected fees for processing Paycheck Protection Program loans for their business clients and for refinancing mortgages for their individual customers. Chris Duncan, a senior loan officer at LaSalle State Bank in Illinois.
That income that we've earned this year far surpasses what we've experienced in the past by many multiples of 10.
Banks have also been making a lot of new loans with interest rates near record lows. Peter Alden is CEO of Bay State Savings Bank in Massachusetts.
Commercial mortgages, residential mortgages, commercial lines of credit, commercial term loans, you know, core meat and potatoes bank lending.
Alden says low interest rates also mean banks can pay less to savers. Bay State Savings Bank has reduced rates on its savings accounts, money market accounts, and CDs.
Because rates have come down with the Fed, we've been able to move our deposit costs down on a product-by-product basis to improve our margin.
But low interest rates also mean those new loans the banks are making aren't earning much in interest, says Chris Duncan at LaSalle State Bank.
We're earning much lower rates on mortgage loans, on commercial loans. All the rates are so much lower.
Meanwhile, this year's windfall of fee income won't last. So Duncan's bank is trying to cut costs where it can. It outsourced the management of its ATMs. That'll help the bank save money on maintenance and labor. It's also installing new technology to make its tellers more productive.
I think banks really are going to be looking at every possible opportunity to try to find a way to cut costs and increase efficiencies.
Banks are also concerned about the financial health of their borrowers. Nathan Rogge, CEO of the Bank of Southern California in San Diego, says he's planning accordingly.
Not that we're seeing any deterioration today, but just kind of looking forward and needing to be conservative and thinking about what does this look like for our commercial real estate clients or hospitality or restaurants.
So, Bank of Southern California is setting aside some fee income to cover any loans that might go bad. Rogge says he's worried that commercial real estate clients might start to see more vacancies.
What are the vacancy rates going to be going forward? Are businesses going to need the same amount of real estate? You know, would they be able to make their mortgage payment on that building?
Rogge says banks will downsize their real estate footprints, too. His bank closed 3 branches this year because, he says, banking is moving online. I'm Justin Ho for Marketplace.
Should you be looking for something to listen to early of a Monday morning, might I recommend David Brancaccio and the Marketplace Morning Report. Everything you need to know to start your business day. Coming up.
So they've parked a bunch of capacity in the desert.
Capacity here being airplanes that are not flying. But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrials up today 47 points, 10th percent, 30,046. The NASDAQ down, though, 27 points, about 2/10 percent, 12,377. The S&P 500 down as well, 10th percent, give or take, 36.63. For the 5 days gone by, the Dow down 0.5%. The NASDAQ dipped 0.6%. S&P 500 down 0.9%. Just 20 days ago till the end of the year, what were we most looking to buy in 2020? Well, according to Google Trends Analytics, the top 5 Google searches for where to buy are in order. PS5, I suppose it's what to buy, right? The latest PlayStation. Number 2, toilet paper. Seriously, people? Number 3, face masks. Okay. Xbox Series X is number 4. Number 5, hand sanitizer, because as we've mentioned here, oh, so many times, the virus is the economy. Bonds rose, yield on the 10-year T-note down 0.89%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Hey there, I'm Bridget, co-host of Million Bazillion, Marketplace's podcast for kids about money. I want to tell you about our email newsletter course, Million Bazillion Academy. In this new and improved course, we'll help your kids learn about crypto, credit cards, and inflation in just 6 weeks. Each lesson comes with a podcast episode, a fun cartoon, discussion questions, and an activity that lets kids apply what they're learning in the real world. You can start at any time and work at your own pace. Sign up today at marketplace.org/academy.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdal. Could be as soon as next week that Americans can start getting their corona vaccine shots. And remember, shots, you're going to need two. The Centers for Disease Control says frontline healthcare workers and residents of long-term care facilities are first in line. But then who? Essential workers, yes, but with a still limited number of doses available and a whole lot of workers considered essential right now, who goes to the front of the rest of the line? From the Workplace Culture Desk, Marketplace's Megan McCarty-Carino has that one.
Federal guidelines consider almost 70% of Americans to be working in essential industries. Now, many companies and industry groups are making their cases to federal and state authorities that their workers are the essentialist. Jeff Freeman is with the Consumer Brands Association.
There's no doubt that there's going to be a healthy fight over who should be prioritized when it comes to access to vaccines.
His organization is fighting for packaging workers who keep toilet paper and cleaning supplies on shelves. Katie Rose McCullough with the North American Meat Institute is making the case for meatpacking workers.
When we aren't able to operate safely for employees, what happens is a backup of food.
Pilots, bankers, rideshare drivers, the list goes on, all say their workers need the vaccine first. It's a complicated trade-off. Some workers have greater contact with the public, some keep food and supplies flowing, and some keep society functioning, like teachers.
We really have learned how essential schools are to our economy.
Kathy Griffin is the president of the Illinois Education Association. She says while many teachers are able to work remotely, getting them safely back into classrooms will benefit children and their parents who can get back to work. It's up to each state to decide who gets the shots when, and right now, those plans are all over the map. I'm Megan McCarty-Carino for Marketplace.
Oil, sure. Copper, you bet. Steel, absolutely. Critical commodities that people keep an eye on to help track the state of the global economy. Here's another one that's going to be real big real soon. Frozen carbon dioxide, essential for keeping the Pfizer vaccine cold enough. Marketplace's Erica Barris has dry ice supply and demand.
Just about every day, Reggie Wright, a sales manager for Roberts Gas in the D.C. area, gets calls from his anxious clients. Food packagers, industrial cleaners, hospitals, and labs that ship specimens. They want to know,
do we think there'll be a shortage? And do we think we'll have any problems supplying the quantities that they are guessing they may need?
Because demand for dry ice is about to spike. And a whole bunch of industries are worried. Rebecca Sweeney of the Wisconsin Cheesemakers Association.
Without dry ice, we would not be able to get dairy cultures out there, and as a result, would not be able to process milk.
She says manufacturers use 350,000 pounds of dry ice a week to make cheese cultures. So whatever it costs, they're going to need to buy it. Now, dry ice sells for $1 to $3 a pound. It's a solid form of carbon dioxide. Prices started climbing in the spring because of the pandemic. Sam Rushing is president of Advanced Chirogenics. He's been consulting to the industry for more than three decades. The new shutdowns?
It could precipitate more shortages.
And higher costs. Terry Esper is a supply chain expert at Ohio State University. He says the prospect of scarcity could be an opportunity for innovation.
We're going to start exploring additional ways of maintaining temperatures while in transit that require solutions other than dry ice.
But he says, in the meantime, while the vaccine gets priority, smaller businesses and non-essential industries may end up losing out. I'm Erica Barris for Marketplace.
Be Bill Gates suggested the other day that the way he sees it, more than half of all travel that is done for business is just not going to come back after the pandemic's under control. That would be of concern to hotels and rental car companies, but perhaps most of all, airlines. Business travel is commercial aviation's biggest profit center, so if Gates is right, or even half right, really, there are some adjustments that are going to have to be made. Marketplace's Andy Euler talked to some business travelers and some business leaders about what their travel plans might look like in the months and years to come.
Before COVID, Andrew Mobley says he was on 8 to 10 flights a month for his job. He's in sales for RealPage, a property management software company. He lives in Dallas, but his territory is California and Arizona.
Going from Dallas to LAX, staying in LA for 2 days, 3 days, that's a $4,000 trip.
That's the flight, hotel, rental car per diem, taking clients out to dinner. He says in March, that all stopped. He's doing everything by Zoom these days.
I think it's shown that we don't necessarily need the travel. It's not, you know, as required as it once was before technology, you know, before we had Zoom and even teleconferencing.
He hasn't heard anything official yet about whether his bosses will send him back on the road once the pandemic ends, but he expects his company will scale back the travel budget. It's just so much cheaper to stay put. Chris Anderson is a professor at Cornell's School of Hotel Administration. He says pretty much every company is having the conversation about the value of meeting clients in person versus connecting over the computer.
For the most part, we're super productive in this model. And so I think what that means is there's going to be some hesitation in the business sort of side of things to go back to the way things were.
He says he could see as much as 25% of business travel just never coming back. And for airlines, that's a major hit. Business travelers make up about 10% of airline passengers, but they account for between half and three quarters of revenue. Business class is more expensive, so the profit margin is higher. Bank of America estimates business trips contributed $334 billion in revenue to the entire travel industry last year. Anderson says business travelers will probably be paying more for flights for a while as airlines deal with diminished demand.
They've parked a bunch of capacity in the desert. They're not sort of taking on new planes as quickly as they would have otherwise. And so what that means is that will be another barrier to business travel because it's not going to necessarily be cheap to travel as the airlines are slow to add that capacity.
Alan Andrews isn't all that concerned about the price of a business class plane ticket. He's VP of sales at Zeus Industrial Products, which makes tubing, insulated wire, and fiber optic cables for the energy, healthcare, and automotive industries. He just wants to get his 50 to 60 sales reps out of their home offices.
When it gets down to it, our business is best done face-to-face. And we want to get out. We want to see the customers. We want to see the engineers. We want to see people. And we want to build those relationships.
His sales team in China is already there, meeting with customers in person. He's looking forward to that day in the U.S. and says so far there's been no talk of his company reducing its domestic travel budget after the pandemic ends. I'm Andy Euler for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today, never pleasant to think about taxes, I know, but the Internal Revenue Service made it official today. The new Form 1040 is out, and the tax people are going to want to know if you've got any cryptocurrency. Specifically, the question reads, at any time during 2020, did you receive, sell, send, exchange, or otherwise acquire any financial interest in any virtual currency? Somehow, and I cannot imagine why, the IRS thinks Bitcoin and the like aren't always being used, shall we say, above board. Also, can I just say, it's still not a postcard. I'm kidding. That was never going to happen. All right, we are going, but not without your Friday moment of economic context, international edition this time. We talked a little bit on the show this week about Brexit and how a deadline looms for some kind of agreement between the UK and the European Union to make a deal. It's the end of the year, by the way, that deadline, and how they are not realistically going to get it done in time. Well, you know who pays attention to that? Currency traders. That's who pays attention to that. The British pound is at three-month lows today amid prospects of a no-deal Brexit becoming oh so real. What happens when your currency is low? We've done this bunch of explainers. It becomes more expensive for you to import stuff, which the Brits are going to have to do also and pay tariffs on, by the way, if there is no deal. Anywho, our theme music was composed by BJ Lederman. Marketplace's executive producer is Nancy Fargali. Nancy Cassett is the managing director of news. I'm Kai Rizdal on a Friday afternoon. We will see you Monday, everybody. Have yourselves a great weekend. All right? This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.